Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review. On the show today, I'll be joined in the studio by Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, and Nancy Durant, the Times Arts Commissioning Editor, as we whiz around theatre productions and art shows on in London this week. Plus, we'll head down to Bankside for an art show taking place on bumper cars, we'll take a whiff of some olfactory art, and as always, we'll be running through the music charts of another country around the world. Stay tuned to find out where. That's all to come on the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. Matt and Nancy, welcome to the show. We're going to begin proceedings at the theatre, and more specifically at Wilton's Music Hall, where I believe you were just last weekend, Matt.
That's right, the other night.
So tell us what you were there to see.
Well, this is a production of Othello, which began in Bristol. It's a touring production. It's going on to the continent. English Touring Theatre is very much part of it. The director of it, Richard Twyman, runs ETT. And there's been so much talk recently about these celebrity productions of Shakespeare, Benedict Cumberbatch doing this and Andrew Scott doing the next thing and Martin Freeman and whatnot. And we forget that there are these wonderful, wonderful ensembles of actors where you don't necessarily know who any of them are, but boy, do they deliver the text big time. And this is exactly that kind of production. It's small, it's compressed, it's got a sort of hurtling urgency to it. It's modern without kind of commenting on its modernity. There are no cell phones. People don't talk about the Kardashians. But it has a sort of vigor that is of the here and now. And the casting is very interesting. People probably know that Othello essentially centers on two couples, Othello and Desdemona, and then his nemesis Iago and Iago's wife Emilia. And in this production, I've never seen it kind of work out this way before. The Othello and the Desdemona are very young. Both the actors, who are very good indeed, are a year or so out of drama school, so that's interesting. And then the Iago and the Emilia are much older. They're actually a previous generation. So that gives a whole kind of age texture to it, in addition to everything else that courses through a play that in this reading really is so unimaginably bleak. I mean, you think you've bottomed out with Shakespeare's tragedies, but when you see them done as well as this is, you realize that they peer right into the abyss. There is no turning back.
What did you make of the younger actors, the younger couple, Othello and Desdemona?
Well, the Othello, who is called Abraham Papoula, has a remarkably ageless quality about him, actually. And I'm not sure that if you didn't know already that you would guess he's a year out of drama school. He looks like he could sort of be more or less any age within reason. And I say that as a compliment. The thing about him that's fascinating physically is he is enormous. He looks like he's about 7 feet tall. And when he deals with Desdemona for much of the play before things, spoiler ahead, go wrong, it's usually in terms of carrying her, picking her up, cradling her, throwing her over his back. And their sort of verbal byplay is as nothing compared to their physical byplay. And that is cunningly juxtaposed by Richard Twyman, the director, with the relationship between, again, Iago and Emilia, where at one point it looks like Emilia is going to come in towards her husband for a kiss, which you might expect a wife would do with a husband. And Iago visibly recoils. He's not interested. So that is perhaps another reason why Iago is not sure what he thinks about Othello. Maybe there's all sorts of sublimation going on. So Papoula really delivers on the part. I think actually, though, Nora Lopez Holden as Desdemona achieves the trickier task because that, you know, all these young Shakespeare women like Ophelia, even to some degree Juliet, particularly Ophelia, they can be so hard, so thankless, Cordelia and King Lear. They're kind of dewy and innocent. And Nora Lopez Holden gives Desdemona a spine, some spirit, intelligence, agency, and it's quite a good performance of an almost intractable part. So I was very impressed with her.
And I've always felt that Othello's kind of, hang on the performance of Iago, because Othello changes his mind so quickly, that transformation happens so quickly, that the persuasiveness of Iago really is important. And Iago is played by Mark Lockyer here. What did you make of him?
He's done the RSC, you know, he's an actor who's been around in all sorts of companies and guises, and he's terrific. The last Iago I saw, funnily enough, was in New York, Daniel Craig as Iago opposite David Oyelowo as Othello, in a not dissimilar production to this, actually, in terms of its style. The thing about Lockyer that I really thought was intriguing was he speaks the lines very fast, with a lot of body language. I mean, lots of hands, for instance. And you feel as it goes on that he can't contain his own thoughts, that he actually is beginning to lose his grip psychically, verbally, spatially, sexually, whatever else. And there's a bit at the end where Iago, famously, the very end of the play, asked to explain his actions, he says, from this point forth, I never will speak word. And from that point on, usually, Iago becomes this kind of blank-faced cipher. Not here. After he says that, he then at one point laughs, and then all the way through to the end of the production, he smirks as if he's absolutely gone over the deep end. And the more the tragedy mounts up, the more he's getting a thrill out of it. And I thought that was fascinating.
And do we get any insight into his motivations here? Because obviously, again, that's a very common thing to focus on. Does he have a motive? Is he just pure evil? Or is there something deeper?
Well, yeah, you know, that whole famous thing about motiveless malignancy, yeah. Which is one of these things we learn in you know, college English. I've never really bought that phrase anyway, because I think the problem with Iago is there are arguably too many motives. I mean, on the one hand, he's passed over for a job that he wants that he doesn't get. It goes to somebody else, Cassio. And just a side note, it's interesting in this production, it really points up, they talk throughout the entire play about wanting to kill Cassio. And it's so interesting in this production, you really feel it, that he's one of the people left standing at the end. So the person they're trying to bump off is the one of the ones who survives. So he's passed over for a job. He seems to have no relationship whatsoever with his wife. Does he have a thing for Othello? Possibly. This production doesn't actually play that up as much as other productions I've seen. But I think he feels, of course, the younger guy has the power. So that's interesting. Age is being sidelined. So I think there are probably a handful of reasons you could ascribe. But you know, the great thing about Shakespeare when Shakespeare is cooking is it can't be reducible to one reason. Like most people can't be reduced to one affect. It's a range of things.
And just finally, here we see Twyman decides to focus a bit more on the Muslim heritage of Othello rather than race, which is often what commonly is used. Is that a useful way of looking at the play, do you think?
You know, I actually think if I had a couple of cavils about the production, I wish they'd played with that more, because you get a little bit of that at the beginning and there's an appropriate ceremony and whatnot. But it seems glancingly arrived at. I don't know whether he had other things he was going to do, but it sort of feels a little bit applied rather than from the inside out. Perfectly fine to have, but I would have liked to have seen that explored further, especially in a modern day production where that would have all sorts of ripple effects and resonances.
Okay, Othello is on at Wilton's Music Hall until the 3rd of June. Let's take things over now to the Many a Chocolate Factory, where the first major London production for 30 years of Peter Schaffer's Lettuce and Lovage is taking place. Let's first discuss the plot of this play. So where are we? Where do we start?
Well, the plot doesn't really stand up to a whole lot of scrutiny, but it's essentially about a woman called Lettuce Dufay who traffics in what we would now call fake news. But Peter Schaffer didn't know that term in 1987. They were more innocent times then. And she is sort of saddled with giving tours of this Wiltshire stately home, which has the wonderful name Fustian House. And it's the dreariest stately home apparently on the circuit. And so to lighten things up for herself and of course for her tourists, and I speak as somebody who's been on some of these tours, she decides to embellish with increasing degrees of absurdity and over elaboration. This does not sit well with her employer, who's called Lottie Schön, Anglo-Germanic woman. And Lottie Schön shows up on one of these tours and basically says to Lettuce Dufay, that's it, you're fired. That's just the beginning. Then what happens is that Lottie Schön has a kind of change of heart, shows up at Lettuce Dufay's basement flat in Earl's Court. The two women get drunk and they proceed to embark on a scheme whereby they're going to, well, Peter Schaffer rewrote the ending of the play, interestingly, for when it went to Broadway, and I saw it in London and on Broadway the first time around. In London, originally, it ended with the two women wanting to blow up all the modern buildings in London, which nowadays might be a little weird and might result in the women being sectioned. So the current ending, which makes a lot more sense and certainly went over better in New York, they decide that they're going to give tours of the ugliest buildings in Britain. So they become tour guides in keeping with Prince Charles's famous dictum about the monstrous carbuncle on the face of Britain.
It's fair to say that you didn't love this production.
You know, it's hard because I'm showing my Iago-esque age here, but I did see the original production. The play was written for Dame Maggie Smith and, you know, I mean, talk about a bouquet. She was just remarkable in it. And we were reminded of it actually a couple months ago because there was a memorial service for Peter Schaffer at the National, which I went to. And at the memorial, Maggie Smith, who's now in her early 80s, came on to do a scene from Lettuce and Lovage with her script in hand. She stepped onto the Olivier stage. She didn't look at her script once. She did one of the great set pieces from the first act of Lettuce and Lovage, and she brought down the house. Now, I'm willing to concede that is a difficult act to follow, and I don't envy Felicity Kendall. But I couldn't help but feel weirdly that the two actresses were in the wrong roles. I would have swapped them over, because what Lettuce Du Fay as a part requires is somebody with a kind of singular sort of eccentric comedy, which is kind of what Maureen Lipman has built her career on. I mean, this is the woman who famously played Joyce Grenfell for years. And she's not like Maggie Smith, but she has this kind of sidelong comedy. And I could imagine Felicity Kendall doing Mock Stern, but instead they both seem not quite suited to their parts. At the performance I saw, they didn't seem altogether sure of their lines. And because the play is featherweight, I mean, it really is featherweight. With a great actress, you don't notice. It's a wonderful sort of souffle. But without that, the souffle begins to implode.
I see. And does the plot now feel a little bit tired? I mean, it is 30 years, as we said, since it was written. And I guess many of the play's preoccupations, particularly with modernist architecture, do they feel a bit outdated, do you think?
You just feel like you've heard it all before. Interestingly, Trevor Nunn, who directed it, gave a very interesting interview where he talked about the two characters representing the divided selves of Peter Schaffer himself, the more public and private self. And I'd never thought of it that way. And that is perhaps one way that we can see it now following Peter Schaffer's unfortunate passing. But you just feel the strain of it. For instance, in the third act, it's an old-fashioned play written in three acts, but it's taken here with one interval. And there's a solicitor who comes into the third act because there's the possibility that Lettuce Du Fay is going to be brought up on charges of murder. It's not even worth getting into. But the part of the solicitor is so sort of gerrymandered into the action. And I actually felt really sorry for the actor who was playing it because he really looked as if he wished he could will himself off the stage and just let the two women get on with it. I think, you know, there are actresses who could do this. I'd love to see Eve Best do it. I think she'd be a great Lettuce Du Fay. Both these actresses are, of course, much older now than Maggie Smith and Margaret Tysak were when they did it 30 years ago. And I think if you're going to do it, get a younger generation with a distinct comic sensibility, and it might just about fly.
Lettuce and Lovage is on at the Meunier Chocolate Factory until the 8th of July. Matt Wolfe, thanks very much for taking us through your London theatre picks this week. Now we're going to nip out of the studio, and when we're back, we'll be talking to Nancy Durrant about a couple of exhibitions that have caught her eye this week. But now, down by the river in London, the annual arts festival Merge Bankside is currently taking place, boasting all sorts, from an installation on dodgems to Latin and jazz music performances to a classroom full of robots. Merge borrows various elements of art, music and performance to create an entertaining lineup. Monocle's Holly Fisher headed down to meet some of the people behind it.
You've read them, but you haven't filled it in. What do you think that says about you, young lady?
On the top floor of a disused fire station in London, a fleet of bumper cars are parked and ready for their drivers to take them for a spin. But these aren't your run-of-the-mill fairground dodgems. These are the dodgems of your mind, one of many installations and performances happening this month as part of Merge Bankside Festival.
Merge started 7 years ago. Merge came about because it's about bringing together lots of local communities, because we found that with Tate opening, a lot of the local community found that they felt like they were being pushed out.
That's Caroline Jones, producer and curator of Merge. She tells me how enlisting the help and involvement of locals is key to the festival's success.
So it was more about that you don't just plonk an artwork somewhere. It was about the whole community being involved in that artwork. And it was all about bringing them all together. So then when we did have a show on, they completely understood what the show was about. And then they would bring in their families and other local people that wouldn't necessarily go to an art gallery at all, but they were interested in things that their family had been part of.
The idea behind Merge is to bring together art, music and performance into fun exhibitions that relate to the history of the Bankside area. The festival uses interesting buildings as pop-up galleries and theatres, such as the fire station that we're currently in.
People can forget the history that's there and just see all the new buildings. So we like to bring back the history and sort of tell stories through that history, but also a lot of the pieces to do with interaction. Sometimes we see a building and think we do a lot of research into the history, and then we find artists that could actually make site-specific, site-responsive work to that site, such as when we worked with Alex Chinnick on the Melting House. We'd done a lot of research into the area, and we knew that one of the oldest factories was a candle-making factory, and all of the workers' houses was on Union Street. So we needed to then find a location close to there to build a house out of wax.
This year's lineup includes a celebration of Charlie Chaplin, who spent a lot of time in the Bankside area, music performances on the clipper boats on the Thames by local buskers, and the chance to have your portrait drawn by robots. But today I'm trying out these dodgems that set out to analyse and transform your personality. The exhibition boasts several bumper cars, all designed by different artists to represent different personalities as you drive through a very talkative video installation. Let's give it a whirl.
Hi, I'm Tyler Moorhead. Welcome to Dodgems of the Mind. You've entered a psychological journey, and you're about to navigate the voices in our heads in a dodgem that's been programmed with its own personality. We ask all visitors to complete a personality questionnaire. Now, tell us, which most closely describes your personality? Disappointed, powerful, aggressive, amazed, bored, meh, hesitant, startled, interested, amused, withdrawn, or tell us another.
I think right now I'm probably interested.
We ask, how long have you ever had your personality? All my life, since adulthood, last few years, recently, since earlier today, which seems to be a very popular answer. If you had to take on a personality right now, we ask, which one? We ask everybody to tell us what they're scared of and what disappoints you most. As you can imagine, there are a lot of Brexit and Trump-related responses, but it's everything from homemade cheese to disappointed by themselves. A lot of people, by the time they get to the bottom of the form, are scared of their partner, who they've come with. That's quite a popular response. But some really weird and wonderful things, actually.
So what is the next step after I fill in my personality test and read the health and safety rules, of course?
You should go into the dodgem room.
Now, before we go any further, I have a confession. This isn't the first time I've been on this ride. I went on a few days before I went back to record, and during my first drive, I accidentally ran over Al, the jumpsuited MC who chose my car, and he hadn't forgotten about it.
Al. Good morning, and welcome. Have you filled in your personality test?
Yes, I have. I have it here.
Come this way.
So, what do we have here? What's your name?
Holly.
Holly. And Holly, you've been interested since earlier today.
Yes, I have.
So how did this come about?
Because I was coming here to find out about your dodgems.
I have a memory of you. You hit people with cars. There is a possibility that your personality will be rejigged in the process of this ride.
That's what I'm hoping. I don't want to hit any more people with cars.
Well, let us get you into the dodgem. We've chosen a suitably regretful car for you. After your actions last time I saw you. Here.
Okay, so I'm in a blue car with a sort of camouflage lining. I'm ready.
You may go! Welcome to the inside of your own mind!
Why don't we slow down? What are you doing?
Well, I don't know if I've completely undergone a full personality transformation, though I have been told that I need to wait a few days until it happens, but it's certainly a fun and surreal take on the fairground ride. And that's what Merch does. It makes art and history fun, and hopefully will engage people with their local area and London's art scene. For Monocle in London, I'm Holly Fisher.
Farewell, and thank you for coming on board the dodgems of your own mind.
Merch Bankside is on until the 4th of June. You're listening to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Matt Alagaya. I'm joined in the studio by Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International New York Times, and Nancy Durrant, the Times Arts Commissioning Editor, who we turn to now to talk art. Nancy, let's start at the drawing room in Bermondsey for a show called Graphic Witness, which looks at the role of drawing in protest. It's an interesting theme. What does it uncover, this exhibition?
Well, it's quite an interesting exhibition. Many people probably don't know the drawing room. Lots of people will, but actually a lot of them won't. It's a gallery which has been going for quite some time, and it's entirely devoted to works on paper. Very much loved by artists. But this show, they do group shows, they do solo shows. But this show is a group show, and it's the use of drawing as a tool to kind of challenge the status quo, to kind of bear witness, if you like, to conflict and to protest and as a mediator. It's interesting because actually there are very few, if any, artists in the show who are actual, I suppose, what you would call a direct witness. So somebody who was in the room when the guy was crucified, or standing there on the theatre steps when the guy set fire to himself. So it's very much a sort of, there are two levels. There's the level of them taking another appropriation, let's say, of news photos or posters or other people's stories. But then also there's the mediation level of drawing itself, which takes time, is a very complex way of doing things, and it requires a lot of concentration. And I think there are sort of two different ways to look at this. The immediacy of drawing is one of the most exciting things about it. You know, you can see the hand of the artist, you can see almost the way that they were thinking quite often. There's an exhibition coming up later in the month at the Ashmolean in Oxford, which is about Raphael's drawings. And in that, you can really see what he was thinking and what he was doing and how he was changing things right on the paper. And that is, I mean, it's so exciting. And that is one of the things which is great here. But also, in this context, direct immediacy is not absolutely useful. Because if you have a drawing made by somebody who was there, did see the guy, did watch this happen, or to whom it happened, you tend to get a bit caught up in, oh, look, I'm looking at the work of the person who suffered. And actually, that's quite, although you feel great sorrow or you feel pity, you do tend to sort of limit it to that. What's good about this, about the fact that there is that mediating space, is that you stand in front of this work. What they're doing is they're trying to make you pause for long enough in front of these pieces to ask the questions, what is happening here and why is it happening? And actually, when you flick across a newspaper or you read a story or you see something on the internet, it really does just fleet straight past you, and you don't really think about it a great deal. And I think this, it's really successful in that you stand in front of it and you go, what is that? What is that? What is that? What is that guy doing? What is that, a figure? What is that symbol? What does that mean? Oh God, that's what that means. You know, and it makes you stop for a change.
And does each drawing in this exhibition have a bit of explanation about what the time was? So you really, you're left
not
to
so
just...
much. Okay. I mean, there is information available. There's a book and or rather a booklet, and there's there's your usual crib sheets, but there isn't a huge amount of information. You do have to kind of ask, which is fine because you can ask. It's a tiny place. It's got two rooms, and people in there are delighted to let you know what's going on. You do need to really think about it. I mean, some of them are pretty obvious. There's a particularly kind of punchy drawing just as you walk in, right in front of you, by Nancy Sparrow, which is called Cemetery Chimney. But the way that it's done, she did it in the early 60s. There were quite a lot of Nazi trials going on at the time. There are some little swastikas and so forth, and you immediately think of the gas chambers and the chimneys, and that is very, very immediate. But some of them are not so obvious, and you do need to sort of think about them and take on their atmosphere as much as the actual information, which is either in them or deliberately left out of them.
I mean, when it comes to protest, it's interesting. We're very used to seeing photography and film footage as the means of dealing with protest and protest movements. You mentioned that the drawing is a bit more reflective. Does it also become a little bit more unreliable, I guess, because you do have the artist, you know, taking a few steps back and thinking about it and maybe doing it, I don't know, 5 days after seeing the photo? Do you think, I mean, obviously it's not a historical record, but...
No, I mean, I thought about that when I was going around it, and actually I don't think it's really any more unreliable than most other things. Photography is very easy to fake, and it's very easy to crop, and it's very easy to take at a moment after something's happened, or even just before, and make it look like it's real. Film is very easy. I mean, we're talking on a day after the terrible thing that happened in Manchester earlier this week, and already there was an enormous amount of fake imagery and fake news, again, on the internet. It's very The thing about drawing, and in this case, it's not reportage. It's not trying to tell you this is what happened in 2013 on the steps of this theatre in Tunis. It's trying to look at the things around it, at the fact that, to accentuate the fact that the people standing around, this is a guy in Tunis who set fire to himself in 2013. He was protesting. He was a cigarette seller. He was protesting about the high unemployment. And the people and the authorities standing around him, or at least this is what it looks like in the picture, in the photograph, just stood there and watched him burn. And that was the thing that the artist was interested in. And so you have these figures standing around and this man in the centre. It's a monumental piece. Man in the centre, who you really can't tell at first that he's on fire. It's not, of course, it's all graphite, so you don't have the visceral horror of the colour, which is, I think, a mercy. You start to think about, what are these people doing? Why are they there? Why is he doing that? And it's an opening up of the questions around why this is happening, rather than just, this is what happened, you need to see it.
Graphic Witness is on at the Drawing Room until the 9th of July. Over to Victoria Miro now for an exhibition of work by 20th century painter Alice Neal. This concentrates on her series of paintings of people of colour and is titled Uptown. Nancy, first let's talk a little bit about who Alice Neal is.
Alice Neal is a fascinating artist. She never really made much money in her lifetime. She was based, I think, in New York for all of her career. And she had a really interesting family and personal life. But she's just a sort of, the main thing, her sons have talked a great deal about how difficult it was having her as a mother. She's one of those real artists who is entirely and 100% focused on her work, which is something that people always think of as wonderful when it comes to someone like Picasso, but when it comes to a woman like Alice Neal, it's like, oh, that's terrible, she never spent any time with her children. But you know what, fine, she was probably a terrible mother, and that's okay, because she made lots of people are terrible mothers, and she did make an amazing body of work, to be quite honest. I feel sorry for her sons, I will just say that, but at the same time, you know, let's not talk about it that much, because nobody ever talks about it with the boys.
Sure. These are portraits of people of colour, as I mentioned, but they're done through the eyes of a white artist. How do you think that changes the way they've been painted? I mean, if at all, I guess. Is there a bit of a distance? And how unusual does that also make Neal as an artist?
Well, I mean, she didn't only paint people of colour. This series happens to be from, they're portraits made during the, you know, 50 years that she lived in Upper Manhattan, first of all Harlem and then on the Upper West Side. She moved there in 1938 in pursuit of truth, apparently, from Greenwich Village, and probably in pursuit of cheaper rents, I would have thought. You know, she painted all kinds of people, many different kinds of people. This show is curated by Hilton Alce, who is a gentleman of colour himself. And I imagine she painted lots of other portraits during this 50 years, but these are the ones that he's chosen to show. And you know what is great about this exhibition, one of the things that's great about this exhibition, is that unless you are engaging with, let's say, contemporary artists like, I don't know, Kehinde Wiley or Lynette Nyadom-Boakye, You just do not see this concentration of people of colour in paint, on canvas, in one place, pretty much ever. So that is really cool. But what I like about these pictures is that she really bloody looked at people, you know, and she really saw them. She sees them. She's super sharp. Not only does she do very well at expressing a personality and a character from each of these people, she's super sharp on physicality. She really gets the quality of the skin. She's really good at hair, for example. And there's a wonderful portrait of the actor, playwright, novelist Alice Childress, who sort of sits in there like a queen. She's wearing this gorgeous blue strapless dress and this fabulous head thing. But what really touched me about that picture was this line, this one sort of crease in her neck. And that one line tells you absolutely everything, or just a huge amount, about her body, about the softness of her skin, about the quality of it, how elastic it might be, how soft it is, how, and you know, and how nicely plump she probably, you know, all of that stuff. She's just, ooh, it's delicious. But it's just that one line which immediately tells you everything you need to know about how grabbable she is. And I just think it's a sort of, it's wonderful. You know, there's a ballet dancer next to her. Never thought I'd say this. He has a great armpit. You know, it's really wonderful. He's curled up. You're looking at the position. It's really great. Like, oh, fabulous armpit. And then there's a neighbour, a chap called Anselmo. From what I can tell from the painting, I think he's probably Latino. He's looks like just a nice bloke. He used to help her move things around and build shelves and things like that. But she captures not just this guy's character, his sort of ease in her living room, but also she's got the kind of, you know, he's got that really super curly hair that, and he slicked it back with, you know, he is pomaded to within an inch of his life, but it's got this irrepressible crinkle that she has captured so beautifully. And you just, that physicality, that tangibility of the bodies and the faces is just wonderful.
You mentioned there that this show is curated by Hilton Alves, who's, among many other things, a Pulitzer Prize-winning essayist and writer for The New Yorker. How does a writer approach the task of curating an art show like this? Is it different to someone who is kind of more at home, I guess, in a more visual medium?
That's a good question. I, as a writer, have never tried to curate a show. I think it's just that actually he's free. He's free from the history of art, academic world, to just do exactly whatever he wants. Like I said, she probably painted 1,000 portraits in that period, and some of them will not have been of people of colour, but he's chosen those people, I think, just partly just because he wants to show that particular way of seeing and to show those people. I don't think a writer necessarily, well, I guess he's writing a story with those artworks, and he doesn't need to include all of the other academic information about who else she showed and who else she painted and what else she did. I think he just has a much easier job in a way than an art historian, because he can just tell a story that he wants to. And I think that's a wonderful way to see an artist, actually, because it opens up a side to them that you would know if you knew her. You know, you choose, don't you, the way that you think about the people that you know. And I think it just works really nicely.
Alice Neal, Uptown is on at Victoria Miro until the 29th of July. Nancy, thank you very much for your review today. We'll hear from Nancy and Matt again later on in the show, but first let's head to Germany. Olfactory art is becoming more, shall we say, visible. There's Hugo Boss, prize winner Annika Yee's Life is Cheap, currently at the Guggenheim in New York, which integrates smell into complex conceptual installations. This art isn't perfume, though perfumers may create it. As the discipline develops, questions about composition, categorization, and collection arise. Susan Stone met some in the olfactory art world, recently in Berlin, who are working on the answers.
My name is Ashraf Osman. I'm an olfactory art curator.
Only a handful of people in the world share that designation with Zurich-based Ashraf Osman. Olfactory art still has a bit of a stigma, he says, although the discipline is not as new as we think. The first all-olfactive exhibitions were in 2008, although such elements can be found in the work of Damien Hirst and Joseph Beuys, and long before that.
The historical origin of both movements, the conceptual art and olfactory art, are tied. You know, they both go back to Marcel Duchamp, who made it kind of problematic for everyone in the art world afterwards to discuss these issues. You know, he's someone who took a urinal and flipped it on its back and said, this is art. So after that, it was a matter of intentionality.
Duchamp also created scented installations in 1938 and 1959. With this rich history, why is olfactory art dismissed?
Art that is highly regarded is quite political. And I think there is a misconception that olfactory art cannot be political. That perception comes from its association with perfume.
Artist Maki Ueda opens a small tin holding an even smaller jar. Inside is one of her latest artworks.
So we start from the juice of war.
She dips in a paper smelling strip and a grim smell of decay fills the room. Ueda created The Juice of War, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for the 2015 exhibition The Smell of War, curated by Peter de Kupova.
Don't worry, I diluted it.
To evoke the post-atomic bomb horror of burnt and decaying bodies, Ueda used meat to create this powerful scent. fermenting, extracting, and distilling, as she has with almost all of the work she's made since she started in the discipline in 2005. What was then unknown territory now attracts a crowd.
They are ready to smell. Smelling is a very scary thing because you take molecules in your body. People who came to the visual art exhibition, they wouldn't expect to be forced to smell. So in the beginning, it was really hard.
Ueda's works are striking and moving, but also unstable, unrepeatable, unsellable, and uncollectible. Even when bottled and refrigerated, these extracts only retain their original character for about 6 months, she says. Olfactory art pioneers like Ueda tended to compose their own scents. Newer artists are now turning to perfumers with industry experience, like Andreas Wilhelm. Amongst other projects, he created the scents for Shirin Yousefi's The Tales of the Cortex, shown this spring at Kunsthalle Zurich.
Of course, if I work with the artist, they don't really have an idea about perfume. Usually they come with an idea, I want to have a firework in a classroom and you smell a bit sulfur. And then I try to put this idea into the bottle. And of course, I'm always following the cosmetic regulation, so not everything is possible.
Wilhelm's fragrances have registered formulas. They can be replicated, monetized, and ultimately collected.
When you work with someone like Andreas, you get better work, frankly. But when you work with someone like us, you can kind of just do your own thing.
Saskia Wilson-Brown is the founder of the Los Angeles-based Institute for Art and Olfaction, which fosters creative work in scent and also gives awards for it to both perfumers and artists. Wilson-Brown works with both, and musicians too, including Daniela Gesundheit of the band Snowblink.
What we try to do is we try to empower the creative person who wants to work with scent to do it themselves, you know, to come in and to tinker and to figure it out. But more often than not, we end up helping quite a bit, you know. So with Daniela, you know, it was sort of a collaborative thing, but really I was pulling materials based on her, creative brief.
Gesundheit gave this perfumed performance in Berlin, where Wilson-Brown held this year's Art and Olfaction Awards, and plans to open a branch of her institute. She's hoping to not just encourage more artists, but also to further general understanding about smell.
If I'm making a piece about, let's say, religion, and I'm using frankincense, myrrh, musk, and rose to talk about Islam and Christianity, most people won't be able to pick them apart or know the cultural context or know what they mean or know. So the conceptual understanding is three steps removed. And that's the biggest challenge with olfactory art.
Olfactory art continues to become better known, better exhibited, and more multidisciplinary. Still, scent remains the most mysterious of our senses. It's likely that its art world corollary will also long be misunderstood. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Susan Stone.
Now we're almost at the end of today's Monocle Arts Review, but before we go, it's time for the Global Countdown, where we take a listen to the top five songs in a different country around the world each week. Joining us in the studio now is Monocle's Bill Luthi. Bill, where are you going to take us today?
We're heading to Thailand.
Excellent.
Throughout my time trying to do this, I've been looking for a place where Ed Sheeran isn't number one, or where Louis Fonsi, although I love that Louis Fonsi song, it's a struggle to find somewhere where that's number one.
Yeah.
I thought Thailand might just be the answer. In at number five is Mark Tachapon with this song called Same. You're going to notice a theme through this. This one is a sad ballad. It's just an acoustic guitar and a voice. It's about a man. It's not clear what he's done. He's done something wrong. And his girlfriend has decided that is enough.
Oh, no.
And he's saying, look, I'm really sorry. I want you back. I've got a line here. Please don't be angry with me. I'm ready to submit and swap everything for you. Can you come back?
It's powerful stuff.
It is quite, yeah. I mean, that's in Thai. I should mention all of this is in Thai. I've just translated it into English because my Thai is not so hot. That's a nice one. It's nice. It's quite slow, but, you know, put it on in the background maybe while you're listening, to while you're getting on with some work or something. Number four, Bruno Mars. We all know Bruno Mars. That's What I Like.
I mean, this is also in the top five around the world, I would expect, no?
Yeah, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised to see that. But it is impressive that there are three Thai songs in the top five.
Mm.
Should we go to number three?
Yes.
Okay. Room 39 is the band. Everything. And I've got this in Thai. It's Pen Tuk Yang.
Very good. I was wondering, we're not going to hear any Thai words then.
Well, there, we've got that little one there. that's as much as I'm going to do between now and the end of this. This was previously number one, so they liked it in Thailand before it got knocked off by the current number one, which we'll talk about obviously later. It's sad, Matt. It's a sad song.
Another sad one.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know what's going on in Thailand.
Is that really a bit like Ed Sheeran?
It is, actually. So this is more kind of, I don't know how much you know about Thai pop music.
I wouldn't want to show you up.
Okay, fine. Thank you. It's more like classic T-pop. So it's like a straight, like four-person band, really close harmonies, kind of like middle-of-the-road rock, I suppose. But, you know, no acoustic guitar, bass, drums, and then these harmonies.
Quite easy to listen to as well.
Yeah, and kind of funky. You can kind of move around to it. So that's, you know, that's quite good. Although, again, sad lyrics.
Subject matter is sad, even though it's an upbeat-sounding song.
It's about a guy who's been friend-zoned, basically. It's like, I'm always there, my ear's always there for you when you need to rant. I'm your personal alarm clock. I'm always asking if you're okay. He doesn't get anything back.
Oh, that's a shame.
Number two.
We can breeze through this.
Yeah?
Yeah, what is it?
Ed Sheeran.
Okay. Oh, okay. Next.
I just want to say, I have no idea how much money Ed Sheeran's made off this song, Shape of You. Probably able to retire. It's probably best.
If he did
do that. Number one, we've got a clip of this one. Should we play it?
Yeah, please.
What do you think?
What do I think? I think it's quite simple. Is that fair?
If I was in Topshop and that played, I would literally not notice for about 2.5 minutes that it was in Thai.
And then it finished and you'd be like, what just happened?
What did I just hear? Yeah, exactly.
Just lost 3.5 minutes. What's the name? We haven't heard the name. Just in case any of our listeners really want to look it up.
The band is called Zeal. The song is called Wildly or Run Wild. So sad. It's a sad song.
It sounds like it's going to be
it is sad.
Sad lyrics again.
This sounds like a soap opera. So it's about a guy who was in a relationship and he was overthinking the relationship. He didn't really know what was going on. So he was like, right, I'm going to call this off. This isn't working. We should break up. Now he regrets the breakup. It's a tale as old as time, really.
It sounds like he's put quite a lot of the complexity into the lyrics and not so much of that into the songwriting. Really.
Matt! So now he wants her back. He's regretting it. He's asking for her back. You know, he's saying, please come back to me. I'm sorry. It was complicated. I've realised my mistake. Like I said, they're all sad. I think I've got a theory about this. The Thai king died just last year. It's been less than a year. They really, really liked the king. Perhaps it kind of seems a bit, you know, out of order to start writing. You know, lots of times, I like T-pop. A lot of it is upbeat. A lot of it is, you know, a bit like, it's not really like K-pop, but it's that same kind of upbeat, dancey thing, kind of like sugar sweet almost. I think maybe they've kind of dumbed it down a little bit to in respect for the king. That's just a theory.
I like that theory. Yeah, they did change a lot. You weren't allowed to, you know, wear colours outside and things like that. It was serious. Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Bill. That was great. So that brings us to the end of today's programme, sadly. This show is produced by Holly Fisher and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thanks again to Matt and Nancy. Join us at the same time again next week. But for now, let's hear the rest of that number one from Thailand. This is Zeal with Wildly.